I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
Premier League former Calgary Mayor Nahed Nenshi tells us why he's wading into provincial politics and vying to lead Alberta's New Democrats, and why he thinks he can unseat Premier Danielle Smith.
A prescription for peace. A Palestinian-Canadian physician who lost three daughters and a niece to Israeli shelling in 2009 tells us he's lost more family members in recent months, but he has not lost his commitment to peace.
Mob rule as gangs continue to lay siege to Haiti. A reporter in Port-au-Prince tells us the recent violence marks a frightening new low point, but he says he sees a future in which Haitians prevail.
Unsettled, an opposition MP calls for the federal government to reopen the settlement given to Indian day school survivors, saying many, including her own family members, are facing agonizing delays.
Missing the boat after 4 months alone on the water, the first American woman to race around the world solo and nonstop is back on dry land, but already keen to hit the deck once again.
And scatterbrains. A new lawsuit alleges that Black Eyed Peas illegally sampled a classic 90s jam by Scatman John, and that they did it by beboppity popular demand. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that enjoys a game of scat and mouth. Today, Nahed Nenshi made it official. The former mayor of Calgary announced he's running for the leadership of the NDP in Alberta, which would put him on course to run against the UCP's Danielle Smith in the next provincial election. The leadership bid is new terrain for Mr. Nenshi, who's known for his centrist politics, which he symbolizes by making his trademark color purple, a mix of liberal red and conservative blue. We reach Nahed Nenshi in Calgary.
Nahed Nenshi? You want to get back into politics this time, provincially, but why should Alberta's New Democrats choose you to do that?
You know, I have long been known as someone who wears purple. And purple is red and blue, you know, liberal and conservative. But it also means something else. It means that we should reject tribalism and we should be defined by our common humanity. So perhaps purple can be an invitation for people to join the orange. You know, I'm very aware that I haven't been a long-term New Democrat. I'm very aware that I didn't do the hard work of digging this party up to where it is now. And I respect and value and honor that work, and the people who did that work will always have a comfortable home in the New Democratic Party if I become the leader.
What do you say, though? There will be NDP faithful who are hearing what you're saying, certainly, and you're trying to reach out to them. I hear that in what you're saying, but that won't necessarily assuage their concerns. You know, they might be worried that you're going to pull the party too far to the center or even too far to the right from where they're standing.
And it's a very valid concern, and there's no way that I would denigrate that concern. But I want to be clear. I'm not interested in creating my own party. I'm not interested in taking this over, this party. The N in NDP doesn't stand for Nahed, or stand for Nenshi. But we also have to recognize that we have to invite more people into the party, that we can build a better Alberta doing that together.
The Calgary Herald, as you likely saw, ran a story last week with the headline, Danielle Smith's team salivating over taking on a Nenshi-led NDP. It quotes an unnamed source in the premier's office as saying, quote, running against Nenshi would present us with the mother of all target-rich environments, end quote. So are you confident you could beat Danielle Smith in a provincial election?
How awesome is it that they are so scared of me, that they're trying to spin before I'm even a candidate? And, you know, I'll just say that language, the mother of all target-rich environments, it tells you everything you need to know about the UCP. The fact that they would use Saddam Hussein's language about mother of and then say target-rich environments at a moment where around the world civilians are being killed because they live in target-rich environments, tells you everything you need to know about what the UCP cares about. They care about winning at all costs. They don't care about Albertans. I've known Danielle Smith for 30 years, and I know that the person who is the premier now is not the person I grew up with. I know what she has sacrificed for power. I know how to get under her skin. And if anybody, oh yes, I know how to beat her any day of the week.
Are they scared, or do they just know your weaknesses? And they know that the UCP dominated support in rural Alberta, and they know that your support is not in rural Alberta.
Well, they don't know that because they haven't seen me in rural Alberta. They're certainly scared about Calgary. You know, if you do some very basic math of overlaying where I won three elections versus where the NDP needs to win, that's an NDP majority government right there. But, you know, I'm not relying on any of that. I'm going to fight for every vote. They know that I'm a competitor. I have gone against the conservative machine three times and have been victorious over them handily by being outspent by every dirty trick in the book. But here's the thing. There's no genius that they know my weaknesses. Everybody knows my weaknesses. I'm very public. Like Popeye, I am who I am. And yet, you know, citizens still say, you know what? That's okay. That's the guy who always has our best interests at heart.
You mentioned the trans issues, and we've reported on that, certainly, Premier Smith's policies on that. But what would you say to Albertans who agree with how she and her party have framed this issue?
So when you actually ask Albertans, are you uncomfortable with the idea of bottom surgery for kids under 18? Most people would say, yeah, that irreversible surgery makes me nervous. But here's the thing. That's not done in Canada. It's not done at all. But if you ask Albertans, are you comfortable with if someone has been through years of medical treatment with their parents and the doctor and the parents both agree that a particular course of action is the right course of action for that child, are you comfortable with the government saying ideologically you cannot give that child the medically best practice that the parents and the doctor agree with? I think most Albertans would say, well, that's ridiculous.
That's a story, that's an issue that's certainly taken up a lot of real estate in the headlines and a lot of coverage. But even speaking to conservatives in Alberta, they've said that they have other issues in mind that they would rather the government and other politicians focus on. Mm-hmm. What is the top issue you would like to focus on, and what is one thing you would do, concrete thing you would do as premier?
It's getting harder and harder to afford to live here. But in Alberta, there are very specific government policies that are making things worse. We pay 2.5 to 3 times on auto insurance what they pay in Saskatchewan, for example. We are finding it harder and harder as everywhere to get a family doctor. So the biggest change for me would be to go from a government that is interested in just picking fights and wasting money to a government that's interested in making better deals for Alberta and putting us on a better path to a future as the economy transitions.
First, you have to get the NDP members on side. But after that, if that happens for you and you become NDP leader, you said you know how to get under Danielle Smith's skin. How are you going to get under her skin?
Calling her out every single time. You know, in my career in politics, for example, it's very rare to meet someone who just straight up lies. That almost never happens. Of course, you spin, you obfuscate, you try to figure out how you're going to talk Neil Kixall, right? But this woman straight up lies to people. She lies about things like her renewables ban and who asked for her renewables ban. She lies about which lobbyists helped her develop her various strategies.
You seem to be suggesting a different kind of politics and bringing people together, as you said earlier in our conversation, but you're calling her a liar right now.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, people do get me on that. You can't talk about kindness and empathy when you're mean to her. But ultimately, you know, it is about kindness and empathy and bringing people together, but it's also about calling out those who pretend to bring people together while they're punching down on the vulnerable. And that is sadly what we have now.
Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so much. I hope we'll get a lot of chance to talk in the future.
We'll see. Thank you.
Nahed Nenshi announced his candidacy for the leadership of the Alberta NDP today. We reached him in Calgary. Today, Caribbean and North American officials gathered in Kingston, Jamaica, to discuss the growing chaos in Haiti. Gangs have taken over Port-au-Prince, closing off the city's airport and main port. That has caused food and water shortages. The country's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, has still been unable to return to Haiti, and one gang leader is threatening a civil war if he does not resign. Harold Isaac is an independent journalist in Haiti. We reached him in Pétionville, a suburb of Port-au-Prince.
Harold, how would you describe what it feels like to be in Port-au-Prince today?
Well, today we have a bit of a reprieve from the violence of last week, which has allowed for folks to resupply. And it's a little bit welcome, honestly. Yeah. Sadly, we've grown accustomed to disruption. And I think that in a kind of a weird way, people have kind of grown wary and grown more prepared for disruption. But that being said, it still is difficult.
You described what it's been like in the past. Where would you put last week on that scale?
Well, that was a new low. You know, even to Haitian standards, it was a new low because the airport was always considered off limits. And the fact that the airport could be attacked sent shockwaves to folks here.
One of the gang leaders at the center of all this, he's known as Barbecue. His actual name is Jimmy Cherizier. He is calling on the prime minister to resign and says that if that were to happen, you know, they would call a truce and then evaluate the situation. Do you believe that a resignation is all it will take?
Well, there's a deeper issue at stake. Yes, we've been in a challenging situation with the gangs, you know, for the past few years. But should the gangs be deciding on who's going to run or not run this country? In reality, we've seen these kind of false promises from the gangs before. And how do you trust a bandit? You know, so the Prime Minister Ariel Henry is stranded in Puerto Rico right now with no way back home. And because of the void that that creates, you have so many folks fighting over taking what would be considered his position, although that was de facto, right? So it's a very complicated situation.
From what you are seeing and experiencing and reporting on, what do you think would actually diffuse the situation and neutralize the power that the gangs have right now?
Well, Haiti, because, you know, people have been saying Haiti's a failed state and all that. I tend to, you know, disagree. Now, I've also heard, you know, folks saying that it should be a Haitian-led solution. Mm-hmm. And that is dismissive in the sense that it doesn't factor in that what aggravates the crisis is the weapons and the ammunition that these folks are using to wage terror on the population. So we're getting guns that are being dumped literally from the U.S. by people that are smuggling them in. And as a small country and a poor country, it's very complicated for the state to be facing that reality, right? And so what could help is definitely understand that this is no simple problem, that it's a very complex issue that has to be taken from various angles, including security and including governance.
Officials are in Jamaica today. Representatives from the United States and Canada are all discussing the situation. How are you feeling about that meeting?
I had a certain level of apprehension with regards to it and how it was rushed.
But is there any time to wait?
Well, as it's unfolding right now, it's already turning sour. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of tensions to be diffusing. And even Haitians, how they brought in their own proposal. They were supposed to be bringing one proposal and there's seven proposals. So it's going to be very complicated. And then again, you know, we're back at the core issue, which is institutional and constitutional, because there is no mechanism for the situation we're living in right now. And so it's basically asking someone to run and sprint while they have their limbs broken, you know, and so how do you do that? It's not obvious. It's going to take time, you know, and it's going to take a certain level of good faith and will.
How do you feel personally in Haiti right now as you've seen all of this unfold?
Being in Haiti, not only for myself, also for many of my friends, is to us an act of resistance because all the deck is stacked against us. You know, so therefore, you're doing everything you know to help any way you can. So leaving is not really an option for most of us. But there are those who leave, and then there are those who stay.
Is that resistance you're talking about what you had in mind, what you envisioned for yourself when you left Canada to go to Haiti?
Well, to answer that question, it's more how did I get to Canada in the first place? Mm-hmm. Because my late mom, she was a prominent personality here in Haiti, Lillian Pierre-Paul. And I always wanted to walk in her footsteps in a weird way. So I was born in Canada because she was sent in exile by the Baby Doc dictatorship. And I was raised in Haiti when she came back after the fall of Baby Doc. And I spent 15 years in Haiti back then, went to study in Canada, had a family in Canada, a life in Canada, mm-hmm. and then we moved to Haiti in 2015, and I never left kind of ever since. So to me, I feel considerably more useful to Haiti today, bringing the stories to the world so that people know what is going on, explaining the complexities, the various mm-hmm. layers. This is my part.
From this low point, as you described it earlier, if you look or allow yourself to look into the future, what do you envision for Haiti?
I think we will prevail. I honestly think so. I think it'll be complicated. I think it'll be long. But I think that that struggle will lead to something durable, sustainable. But it's going to be painful, and there will be trouble. But I'm hopeful.
Harold, I very much appreciate your time. Please stay safe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Harold Isaac is an independent journalist in Haiti. He's in Pétionville, a suburb of Port-au-Prince. One of the golden rules of radio is to stay away from numbers. You put too many in a row and they get confusing and hard to take in. But it is impossible to tell this next story without a few. So the first number is one, as in one person alone. The next is three, for the three capes she rounded to cross three oceans. From there, the numbers get bigger because Cole Brower sailed 30,000 miles in 130 days on a 40-foot boat. She's the first American woman to ever race nonstop around the world on her own, and she came in second overall in the Global Solo Challenge sailing race. At 28 years old, she was the youngest competitor, and at just 5 foot 2 inches tall, she was the most diminutive. We reached Cole Brower in A Coruña, Spain, where she completed her circumnavigation of the globe late last week.
Cole, congratulations.
Thank you.
What is life on land like for you now after spending 4 months at sea?
I definitely miss being out on the water.
Already? You're ready to go back?
I'm 100% ready to go back. Don't get me wrong. I love land. I love my people, my team, my support, my family. But, you know, I just feel like it's something that I miss at every second of every single day is just that fresh, pure ocean air.
What was the reunion like, though, with those first moments when you came into port and saw your family and your team?
It was so interesting because everyone was crying and I was the only one that wasn't crying. So I almost feel like it was such a beautiful moment, but I feel like it was almost more for my family, my friends, and the people that were there, my supporters, than it was for me.
They had been worried about you?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't think my mother slept for 4 months.
You did keep people informed, including your mom, about what you were doing. You shared a lot of what you were experiencing online, you know, everything from doing your nails to the more serious, you know, dealing with a serious injury to your rib. Let's play our listeners a clip of something you posted back in December.
Hey guys, so I wanted to start this video by saying the last like 24 hours, I've been so angry. angry that things keep going wrong, angry that my ribs hurt so bad. I don't want you guys to think I'm like Superwoman or something and I like don't have any feelings other than positivity, because I definitely have this.
Why was it important for you to share moments like that as well?
That video is actually hilarious because the original video that I'd sent to my media manager was about 10 minutes long and it was me cursing for about 5 of it.
So there was some paring back of the feelings.
For that video in particular, that was my most angry, upset video. I think she did a wonderful job making it a little bit more, I wouldn't say censored, but just appropriate for everyone in my following. But the original video I had sent to, you know, Lydia, I sent to family and friends so they knew exactly how I was feeling, even the raw.
What's it like to hear it now?
It's interesting because it doesn't sound like me, you know? It sounds like I'm almost watching it like a movie from afar. It's not because I'm ashamed of myself, but for me, posting on Instagram, it was, you know, kind of a virtual diary. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just need to get it out.
We mentioned in the introduction your height. You're 5'2". We mentioned that not just because, but because you've been blocked from competing in some races because of your size. Was there a time, regardless of the rules, where you felt it might be overwhelming for someone of your stature?
I really believe because I was never born as a bigger person. Mm-hmm. I've never been a bigger person. I only know what it's like to be a 5'2", 100-pound woman, that I don't really understand what it's like to be a bigger person. And so it's not really that strange for me to go through my normal steps to make things easier for me.
You just figure it out.
You just figure it out.
It sounds like you're pretty self-aware, but this trip must have taught you even more about yourself. What did you learn and what do you want others to learn from this trip?
I have been for years now very driven, and I've pushed really hard. And this race in particular has made me slow down, because you have so much time during the day and you only have a limited amount of food and supplies and spares, that you have to learn to stop and smell the roses. Because if you just gorge yourself and eat all of your food, you know, within the first month, it's going to be very depressing for 3 months after that. So you really, really learn how to slow down, mm-hmm. enjoy life, watch the sunrises, watch the sunsets, and even just be on land. I haven't seen a sunrise or a sunset since I've been on land, and that the 3 days that I've been on land, that's the longest out of 130 days that I haven't seen these things that were so normal in my life offshore. And so it's just appreciating the things that you have. You know, you can't go to the store and buy these things and purchase these things. You have to really truly learn to slow down and enjoy your life and enjoy what you already have.
When are you going back on the water?
God, I would hope as soon as possible. right now, I think the next time I'll be on the water would probably be sometime in June, mm-hmm. for an actual race. But, I mean, things come up every day, so it could be next week or it could be a couple months from now.
Cool. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
All right. Have a good one.
Cole Brower placed second in the Global Solo Challenge sailing race last week. We reached her in A Coruña, Spain.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Starting today, families across Canada will be fasting during daylight hours, gathering in community, in prayer, and in fellowship with other Muslims to mark the holy month of Ramadan around the world. That, of course, includes Muslims living in Gaza, except that they've already experienced months of deprivation, not for reasons of faith or spiritual discipline, but because of Israel's siege. That reality is uppermost in the minds of those entering what is ordinarily a celebratory time of year, and Dr. Izzeldin Aboulaish is no exception. Dr. Aboulaish is a Palestinian-Canadian physician who grew up in the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza and moved to Canada after Israeli tank fire killed three of his daughters and his niece in 2009. The following year, Dr. Aboulaish wrote a book titled I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey, and was our guest here on As It Happens. Now, more than a decade after its publication, that memoir's message is more relevant than ever. We reached Dr. Izzeldin Aboulaish in Toronto today.
Dr. Aboulaish, how are you and your family marking Ramadan this year?
For us, it's not an easy. It should be blessed, a month of mercy, of kindness, of life, of tolerance, of love, of compassion. But there are in this world, my people, my family there, all of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip under starvation, under siege, under continuous killing. And that's what makes me, you know, to feel impotent, paralyzed. What can we do? Because it's man-made.
So as you and your family try to honor this holy time, how do you also honor what is happening there?
Yeah, I honor it really to think of them, even if I want to eat, to think of them, if they are eating, what did they eat? To remember the good days that we used together and to come together to break the fasting. Now they are scattered everywhere. They don't have shelter. They don't have food. They don't have water. Even they don't have the most important, the most precious thing, the loved ones who are under the rubble or they are in their graves. So they are hungry. They are starved. And they are under a threat, existential, continuous, ongoing threat.
Have you been able to speak with your surviving relatives in Gaza?
I try every day. If they have access to internet or to phone connection, they call me. For the last 2 weeks, I wasn't able to talk to them. Only sometimes I text them on the social media, on Messenger. But other than that, it would be difficult because they are disconnected from the world. They can't find food. They can't find water. Even what they can eat, they started to eat the animal food. Even when we speak about the humanitarian aid, there are the airdrops. They say we go there and then we didn't see anything. We didn't receive it. This is a failure of our world. And no one is asking why all of this is happening. It's because we are either biased or indifferent or complicit in what is happening in the world.
You were last on our program, Doctor, in 2010. You spoke with our former host, Carol Off. And at the time, in the aftermath of your daughter's deaths, you told us you were making a very conscious decision to not hate the people responsible. I want to play for our listeners a short clip from that conversation in 2010.
I can say what my daughter Shada said. To hate whom? The circumstances that brought us to the situation, I hate this action of killing. And I feel a responsibility instead of being consumed by what did you say hate is to make my daughter's justice. And to look forward. I hope one day to meet my daughters, to say to them, I did you justice.
Has it become more difficult to keep that promise? And I ask because I hear the tone in your voice, the concern.
It's very painful, but I will never be defeated or to be broken. The promise is still there. I will never allow hatred to approach me. This is important. And also, if the dead and the killed can't speak out, it's our responsibility as living people and loving to speak out and to say no and not to accept it and to do our part in order to make the change. Those innocent people who were killed and the suffering that is happening to be injected into a vein of hope, justice, and life, all of us will be guilty if we consumed it and it to be waste.
What your family has endured certainly underscores the fact that this conflict has gone on for quite some time, even before your family's losses, of course, as well. But that the Hamas attacks on October 7th were not the beginning for many people of what is happening now. Is it important for you that people acknowledge that?
Yeah, because it didn't start October 7th. My daughters were killed 16th of January 2009, 30th of October 2023, 22 members of my family were killed, nieces, nephews. I feel as if it is repeated again. My niece's daughter, who was killed with her 30th of October, she named her after my daughter, Aya, who was killed. My niece, Isra, who is architect engineer, she was killed 30th of October. My niece, Para, who was a medical doctor, she was supposed to start her residency. My nephew, Ali, who is a physiotherapist, 22 members were killed just in one time. And I don't know, honestly, you spoke about my daughter. I want to go back home to visit my daughters, because the first thing I do when I go back home, I go to visit the graves of my daughter. I hope the graves are still there, and to go to talk to them. But the promise I gave them to them will continue and will never give up to advocate for the rights of all, for the justice of all, for the freedom of all, and the dignity of all. This is the guarantee for a stable, sustainable world that we need, because we all bleed the same color. The Palestinians' blood is not different from anyone else. We are people like others. And even some people, in spite of the war, they are celebrating Ramadan. Even some of them, they got married during the war, under the fire. They want to live and to give life. So what can we do to help them to get their freedom? Because I am not free as long as you are not free.
Given everything that's still going on, Doctor, when you hear the word ceasefire, does that feel even possible at this point?
You know, when we speak about ceasefire, it's up to the international community to live by their words and to speak about it in a just, not in a biased or selective way. So they are not supportive of this issue. If the United States, which is planning to build a port in the Gaza Strip, they voted against ceasefire in the Security Council. You know, the United States just to vote in support of ceasefire and the international community to enforce it on all, as they did it in many other countries. And that's what we need, to stop all of this incitement and to use October 7 as an opportunity to understand one thing. Military means war, violence will never put an end. It only leads to more bloodshed, more suffering, more pain, more hatred, and most extreme is to breed more extremism.
What specifically could and should Canada do, Doctor, to help secure a ceasefire?
Canada, as you have seen from the beginning, Canada has been, as always, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, when he said it, we always will stand up for human rights and women's rights around the world. This is part of the longer tradition of Canada engaging constructively and positively in the world. But what are they doing? Even the word condemnation, the word condemnation, I never heard it from the prime minister or any official. Always they are saying, we are concerned, we are sorry about what is happening. You see it, even the government of Canada, they wanted to sponsor 1,000 Palestinians. Until now, I submitted to bring any of my relatives to save them. Until now, it's only just words. No action was taken.
I wanted to ask you about your five other children who survived the attack on your home back in 2009. How are they doing now?
Thank God, the children that they came here traumatized with all of the challenges, and that's the great success. So my eldest daughters, they graduated from the School of Engineering, University of Toronto. They are married. They have their own homes, families. And the third daughter also married with the grandchildren. My eldest son, who graduated from Rotman School of Business, he is working. And my youngest son, who came here at 6, he's graduating this May from Schulich School of Business. So that's the message. We as Palestinians, we are able to create life from death.
I can hear the pride in your voice. I'm glad they're all doing so well. Just before we let you go, Doctor, we began our conversation by talking about Ramadan and this holy time. How does your faith inform your commitment to not hating people, that commitment to nonviolence?
Yeah, of course, my faith is vital, is essential, is crucial in my life. And I believe if all the world wants to do me harm and God does not, they will never do it. And my profession as a medical doctor helped me so much, because if a patient dies, I don't stay there. I have to move to the next patient. But what we need to learn the lessons, why the first patient died, and what can we do to prevent any more deaths. And my life experience, because as a Palestinian, my life experience is, of course, we are tested on daily basis. My life was a war, but I have to take the responsibility and to challenge and not to give up and not to be broken, not to be defeated, and to spread hope. Because as my daughter Bisan said, God bless her soul, violence will never be met with violence. Killing is not going to be met with killing. Revenge, the one who opts for revenge has to dig two graves.
Dr. Abulaish, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Izzeldin Abulaish is a Palestinian-Canadian physician and professor at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health in Toronto. That's where we reached him. At the Oscars last night, a number of nominees wore red pins showing their support for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, and demonstrators calling for a ceasefire delayed the start of the show. But the ceremony itself included almost no mention of the Israel-Hamas war, with one notable exception. British director Jonathan Glazer won Best International Film for The Zone of Interest, a film about Auschwitz and the Holocaust. And in his speech, Mr. Glazer, who is Jewish, spoke out about the conflict.
Thank you to the Academy for this honour, and to our partners A24 Film for Access and the Polish Film Institute, to the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum for their trust and guidance, to my producers, actors, collaborators. All our choices were made to reflect and confront us in the present, not to say look what they did then, rather look what we do now. Our film shows where dehumanisation leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October... whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladziejczyk, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
That was Jonathan Glazer, the director of the Zone of Interest, speaking at last night's Academy Awards ceremony. Two opposition parties say survivors of Indian day schools are being shortchanged by the federal government. Indigenous people who were sent to the schools have received billions of dollars in hard-won compensation after arguing they should not have been treated differently from residential school survivors. But advocates say that many day school survivors have only received the lowest level of compensation, even though they should have been eligible for much more. And after being faced with a complex, time-consuming application process, some have given up. Laurie Idlout is the NDP MP for Nunavut. We reached her in Iqaluit.
Laurie Idlout, this is very personal for you, I know. You lost your mother before she was able to receive her compensation for attending a day school. What kinds of obstacles did she face while she was trying to get that compensation?
I do remember I would ask her how her application was going. She struggled with it because of a few things. First of all, she couldn't remember the years that she went to the day school in Chesterfield and Litt. And there were other obstacles like not knowing who to contact mm-hmm. for notaries and how complicated the form was to get the compensation.
This story first emerged last week in reporting by our colleague Olivia Stefanovic. Jesse Waldron, who's a Cree survivor of the day school system, is taking this case, their own case, to the Supreme Court because they say that survivors have been shortchanged by this process and re-traumatized by the compensation process, all of the hurdles that you've been talking about. And the compensation that's been given has mostly been in the lower range. So they're saying more people are entitled to higher sums. I wonder what it's like for you personally. What does it feel like knowing what your mother and others went through in the day school system to see these kinds of obstacles now?
It's definitely super frustrating, especially hearing in the news how much the lawyers received to make sure that survivors get their compensation. Like after my interview with Olivia Stefanovic, I later thought, why would they tell me to do up more paperwork for an estate lawyer if they are the ones who are supposed to be hired to do that kind of stuff? Why is it up to my family to do that paperwork when they've been the ones who are hired to ensure that individuals or their descendants get this compensation? Like, why is it up to us to do their work?
And the amount that you're referring to is $65 million they received to administer the deal. That's scowling. So what would you like to see the federal government do now?
Well, they should make it easier to ensure that families and survivors get that compensation. Like, the amount is not enough anyway, given how much grandchildren are still subjected to intergenerational trauma. Like I've shared this before with others, that I saw my mom not being able to overcome her grief, her issues, and she always refused to see mental health counseling because she didn't feel that it would help her. Like, she's suffered so much trauma throughout her life that it didn't make sense that they had to do so much paperwork to get the meager $10,000 that wouldn't even go far enough to help her grandchildren who suffered the consequences of that trauma that my mom inflicted on them.
$10,000 compensation is on the minimum end of what can be offered, and Jesse Waldron, who I mentioned before, said they could potentially be eligible for up to $150,000. So that's quite a big difference. We were talking about life-changing amounts of money they would be for anyone. Do you feel that overall there's a difference in understanding or appreciation of what happened at day schools compared to residential schools? Do you feel that there's a misunderstanding there about what people experienced?
I think that there's not enough communication about how much trauma was still suffered. Like, it matters, for example, that former students did have to travel much farther to get home to their families. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that students who lived in the same community didn't suffer the same abuses in those schools. They may have gotten a little bit of more help from their families in the same communities, but that's still not guaranteed, because a lot of what was going on in the schools were hidden from Inuit mm-hmm. families over all those generations.
Former Attorney General David Lametti, you know, seems to be suggesting in Olivia's reporting that the intentions were good, but that there are some issues here. Current government ministers seem to be acknowledging that things could be rolled out better. There's things to learn from here. Does that give you a sense that you might see some different moves from the government on this?
Since I've been elected, I've been subjected to a lot of empathy, but I've not seen enough action. So I don't think that empathy is enough anymore, not after years of knowing, not after years of apologies, not after years of continual underinvestments in ensuring that Inuit, First Nations, and Métis can finally experience healing that will allow them to stop passing on intergenerational trauma so that they can start focusing on passing on intergenerational love. The continual underinvestments in mental health and wellness, what they say as empathetic words is not enough, and we need to make sure that there's more action.
Lori Idlout, I thank you for your time.
And I do appreciate that you're doing this story. It's very important.
Thank you.
Lori Idlout is the NDP MP for Nunavut. We reached her in Iqaluit. Amid the bits that fell flat, the waxing on about the magic of movies, and the endless jokes about how endless the Oscars are, there were some moving moments at last night's Academy Awards. Like when they cut to Messi the dog and he was clapping. Did you see that? Or when Messi pretended to pee on Matt Damon's Walk of Fame star. Or the fact that Messi was even there after it was announced that he wouldn't be there. It was all so emotional. But also, humans did say things. This was one of them.
Wow, thank you so much to the Academy. This is incredible. Thank you. Thank you so much. The Last Repair Shop is about the heroes in our schools who often go unsung, unthanked, and unseen. Tonight, you are sung, you are thanked, and you are seen. Thank you all so much for what you do. John Williams inspired me to become a composer. He went to LA Public Schools. I went to LA Public Schools. LA is one of the last cities in America to give public school students free and freely repaired instruments. And we need to fix that, because music education isn't just about creating incredible musicians, it's about creating incredible humans.
That was Chris Bowers accepting the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short. Mr. Bowers made The Last Repair Shop with Canadian co-director Ben Proudfoot. It's a film about the people who fix instruments for public school kids in Los Angeles and the students whose lives have been changed as a result. When his film was nominated, Neil spoke with Ben Proudfoot, who told us how the film's stars had reacted to the news.
It was, ecstasy, elation. If you can imagine, right, working away, toiling away for 10, 20, 30 years fixing instruments, and then to suddenly receive the admiration and adulation of the world, I can really only imagine what that must feel like for them. And it's so well deserved.
I watched the film this morning. It's just under 40 minutes long. And I have to ask, how dare you and your co-director, Chris, make us smile and cry that much in 39 minutes and change? How dare you?
Sorry, not sorry.
I'm not sorry either. It was, I mean, you know, got to keep journalistic objectivity, but it was a pleasure to watch. How did you both find out about this last repair shop?
Yeah, so our producer, Jeremy Lambert, gets the credit there. His brother is a luthier, and this article about the repair shop back from 2013 caught his eye. I was just drawn in by the photo. There were some photographs, and I was drawn in by this sort of North Pole of musical instrument repair, and was surprised and proud to learn that it was the last in the country. And then Chris, who's one of my closest friends, and I was working with him on a film called A Concerto is a Conversation, I brought it to him, and he said, oh my God, I went to LAUSD, and I didn't know about this.
Oh, wow.
And that's when the sort of collaboration began, and it was so funny. Steve, the piano tuner in the movie,
yes.
It ended up that he actually tuned there are 6,000 pianos in LAUSD. He tuned the elementary and middle school pianos that Chris Bowers learned how to play piano
on. Oh, wow. Steve's story in the film is so incredibly moving. We won't give it away here, but Chris is a composer as well. And everybody talks yep. about the impact of that one instrument, whether it was from, you know, yes. a thrift store or given to them by the school program, how it was a joy, but also a passport in many ways.
Yes. No, that's a great way to put it. Yeah. Transformative, right? You hear it from the kids in the movie too, that it's a tool that as a little kid can give you power. It gives you a tool to express yourself. It teaches you creativity and collaboration and sensitivity. And those are all things that we need in our schools and in our world today. And so this movie is a vehicle to get people to stand up and cheer for music and arts education.
Halifax filmmaker Ben Proudfoot won his second Oscar last night for the documentary short The Last Repair Shop. He spoke with Neil in January. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.